It is just about 23 minutes after the hour on this Tuesday morning. Dr. Don Clark, discovered him online just a few minutes ago, and I thought, hey, let's talk with Don. Oh, wait a minute. We used to do this every Tuesday, didn't we? I remember that. Yeah.
Yes.
Just like every Tuesday.
We prearrange.
Yeah. It's been a couple of weeks, though, and it's good to kind of get back in the groove. David and I, as most people listening have heard already, we talked about it yesterday, were off at the Institute of Biblical Context Conference in Michigan last week, and so we were automated all week, and so we missed our conversation. So how are things in Garden Valley out on the grape branch there?
Oh, well, the grapes are growing. Mm-hmm. The little grape berries are getting bigger and bigger by the day. They haven't turned color yet, so that means we at least have maybe another month before the first harvest.
Yeah, we've got some new listeners. I should explain. Dr. Don Clark is a biochemist, also a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he also runs a vineyard and a winery there in Garden Valley, Texas, which is about 80-90 miles east of Dallas. And it's a beautiful place, Garden Valley, and you planted that vineyard in 2011, and you were winning awards by 2013 with your wine. That's pretty astounding, I say.
Well, we made our first wine in 2013, mm-hmm. and I think I submitted it 2014 or 15 to an international winemakers competition and won a gold medal off of it.
And so,
was that from grapes that you grew, or was that grapes you bought?
Oh, no, grapes that we grew.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. And then we talk about this because Don runs his...
That same field is producing 5 tons. So,
learning about grapes and planting and wine is almost as interesting as learning about genetics. Isn't it, guys?
Oh, is this what you call a segue?
This is a segue, yeah.
Our topic?
The best. Once we get into wines, David gets all cranked up here. And
a very good segue, but a segue nonetheless.
Well, it's going to have to do, I think. We're looking at an article from New Scientist Daily, and I'll go ahead and put the link in our chat window in just a minute. But it has to do with the Y chromosome and supposedly some new discoveries that cast into doubt everything they've believed about human genealogy and human... Don, how does this happen? Every time they come up with a new discovery, it cancels out what they thought to this point. Now, that's the way scientists are supposed to work. But then they present the new evidence as if it's a certainty, knowing that they've messed it up repeatedly in the past. In this case, they're claiming a whole new age for human beings, older than the 140,000 years they had previously assumed. How does that work in science?
Well, you know, this is both, you know, genetic markers, for example, that they use to say that, okay, you send in a sample of DNA, and then, you know, they send you back and say, you're 5% Italian, and, you know, you got Irish in you, and you got all these other mixtures, and here's the percentage. And you often wonder, okay, come on, you know, how do they know exactly how much percentage that is? But they're, you know, different cultures, different people group have a commonality to their genetic makeup. And so based on that commonality, they are able to say, you know, you with some degree of certainty that you've got, you know, 12% Italian or whatever it happens to be in you. Well, this is kind of the same. This was the same thing, except that this sample of DNA came from Albert Perry. After he died, his relative sent the sample to do a DNA study because they were interested in their family tree and where their grandpa and pa came from. And when they sent it in, they got back that, oh, wait a minute here. His Y chromosome had some markers that isn't in common with everybody else. It's like, oh, gee, you've got something there that... You know, our database doesn't contain.
An anomaly, you might say. Yeah.
It was an anomaly. and so that led then to, you know, further explanation, exploration, and they sent it to Michael Hammer, a geneticist at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and he determined that, oh, well, this other unique aspect of Perry's DNA looks like it's comes from the ancient pre-human, you know, species, if you will, that may have coupled with humans back in 300 and, you know, I mean, this is ridiculous that they would state it like this, 338,000 years ago. I mean, it's, you know, they can pinpoint it that closely.
Well, then they talk about a genetic atom. Previously, they had thought that all Y chromosomes go back to the same individual, which makes sense even biblically. But then they say this genetic atom that is the first man lived between 60,000 and 140,000 years ago. Now, that's quite a spread. It's less than precise. And so they, now they get this new Y chromosome and they say, bing, 338,000 years. How come they're not as unsure of that as they should be about their previous research? I mean, that's the thing that... And they talk about ancient African humans as opposed to modern humans as if they were different races. In fact, they you occasionally see in these write-ups, they're referred to as different races. And yet, if they can breed with each other, by definition, they're of the same kind, that is, the same race, correct?
That's correct. Yes, of course. I mean, that's not... I mean, race... We've used the term race kind of loosely to... depict certain phenotypic characteristics, you know, slanted eyes for the Asians, for example, and kind of yellowish, you know, skin. And of course, we have the, you know, the black folks and the Indians, the red skin, and, you know, those type of things. And we typically say, okay, they're a different race. In actual fact, they're just people that migrated certain, you know, certain places. But if you go back to your biblical roots, if you go back to the, you know, chronology in what's in the Bible, and you can search, and we've talked about this before, you can search and discover that, oh, well, this group of people migrated this way, this other group of people migrated this way. We all came from the original, well, of course, we all came from the original Adam and Eve, but, you know, after the flood, we all came from one of Noah's sons, right? Shem, Ham, or Japheth. So we are all descendants of either Shem, Ham, or Japheth. And sometimes, of course, since it's been over 4,000 years, we're... Some of us are probably a mixture of all of those guys, as well as their wives, of course. You know?
Of course, we talked about an article just a couple of weeks ago that essentially reached the conclusion, based upon very contemporary modern DNA research, that says there really is no human race that is distinguishing between groups of human beings, that the percentage difference in DNA between, say an African-American and an Anglo-American is no greater than the difference between, say, a Swede and a Frenchman. That is geographical differences rather than what we would call racial differences. The conclusion of this article was there's only one human race, black, white, yellow, brown, whatever. The DNA differences are so minor that you can't really separate them into races.
Right, and there are markers for. I mean, you know, if you think about it, as each time, you know, the DNA divides, as far as, you know, procreating and producing, you know, a new human, for example, it's going to be slightly different than the parents, or it's going to have a mixture of both the.
But
the,
that's
the
due in part to mutations, correct?
That's excluding mutations. Now you put mutations on top of that, And, you know, we've already talked about that. Oh, you know, every generation there is some addition of mutations, and we kind of know what the mutation rate is given a certain period of time. And if you look at the mutation, the degree of mutations that we have in our genetic pool, you know, today, it actually correlates quite nicely with saying that, oh, gee whiz, the humans, the whole of not only human race, but all of the animal kingdom, it can't be greater than 10,000 years. And you would think that people would say, where have I heard that number before? Or 6,000, you know, between 6,000 and 10,000 years, where have I heard that number before? And then they would say, oh, wait a minute, that's kind of the lineage, and that's kind of the time frame one gets from the Bible. So maybe we look a little bit closer into Genesis and Chronicles and see where we came from. Maybe it has the answers, and we don't have to do these type of studies. If we do these type of studies, this genetic type of marking studies, if you will, then we get a clearer picture as to where people migrated from. And when you do that, you actually see that everybody might have migrated from Turkey, where, you know, the land of Shinar, where the Ark kind of settled, and then people kind of accumulated for a while until God came down and confused their languages because they were, you know, building a temple, trying to get up to God so that they could be God. They wanted to be gods, just like God is God. They wanted to be gods. And so God had to stir things up a bit, and now they couldn't talk to each other, but they did migrate with common languages. So that meant, at that point in time, the genetic pool that was in Shinar then, at the Tower of Babel, separated into the various people groups that we have today.
You know, wouldn't it be interesting if one of the world's leading geneticists would pick up the phone and call another of the world's leading linguists and combine their knowledge? Because what it seems to me that all these scientific reports from geneticists particularly are rife with assumptions. And if they would start with a pattern, a matrix, a common bit of information, such as the Bible, such as the biblical story of creation, it would take many of those assumptions and cast them out while affirming others and lead them in a solid, provable, verifiable, believable direction. But that doesn't seem to happen. I don't think scientists communicate with each other very well.
No, they don't. I mean, even though there's all kinds of journal articles, and it would take, I admit, even when I was doing, basic research, it takes a lot to even keep up in a very narrow field, much less broaden the horizon to keep up with everything that's going on in all of science. A PhD should give you a general education so that you could look into any field and be able to understand, you know, certain aspects of it without going, you know, super, super deep in the field. But, you know, be that as it may, we tend to concentrate in the areas that we know well. And so we delve deep as opposed to delving a little bit broader and taking in, you know, concepts from what other people have discovered.
Well, you say concepts now, from other people. We tend to throw out all of ancient knowledge because those were ignorant savages, hunter-gatherers without any scientific knowledge, and yet they survived. You'd think we'd give them more credit.
Well, yes, we would. You would think that they would give them more credit, especially when you find things out like, hey, you know, when they were building the Tower of Babel, I mean, that was an engineering feat. When you look at the Egyptian, pyramids, that's an engineering feat. When you look inside and you find batteries and evidence that the ancient Egyptians, for example, these are ancient people who were ignorant, they were doing cataract surgery. And it goes on and on and on. And, we hear of people groups having some type of wings that they flew from place to place. So we think that, oh, we invented the airplane, and now, you know, we travel all over the place in the air. There were people, ancient people, that were doing this, probably not with a powered aircraft, but they would get on top of a mountain, and they, you know, we call them gliders. I mean, mm-hmm. That just for recreation now, not for transportation. But there were people groups that were doing it for transportation. So these ancient peoples weren't ignorant. And matter of fact, you know, based on devolution, the theory of devolution as opposed to evolution.
And this is Dr. Don's theory of devolution. We need to give you credit where credit is due here.
Now I noticed something in the language, you know, as you're talking, Don, and sometimes when we, you know, continue on discussing, we toss out terms like the theory of devolution and then continue talking, just hoping that nobody will remember what you just said. And then two or three sentences later, somebody will say, theory of devolution, that makes a lot of sense.
Hey, don't Google it, though.
I'm wondering, is from your feel, I mean, I don't think you've done any research on this, but how far away do you think we are from someone coming up with a theory that counters evolution?
Well, I mean, the creationists have been countering evolution, you know, since for a long time, since mm-hmm. Henry Morris, you know, and the Institute of Creation Research had come into being, and many others that noticed that, hey, you know, evolution, we didn't evolve. The Bible says that God created Adam and Eve, and so anybody who takes the Bible seriously and is a serious scholar of the Bible understands, and you don't have to necessarily look from a genetic point of view at the genetic makeup of beings, whether they're animals or humans here on Earth, that everything, or in plants for that matter, everything is very, very complex, and it couldn't have just fallen into place through a chaotic process. It had to be a very well-defined, purposeful putting together of all of the information needed in order to have a living being. That goes for plants, that goes for animals, that goes for even, microbes like bacteria and viruses. Even viruses are complex. I mean, can you imagine a segment of RNA, for example, that is designed so well that it just happens to, when it gets into its host, let's just talk about the tobacco mosaic virus, which is one of the most well-known viruses. Here's a virus. So the RNA is encapsulated into protein coats, and it's got a little injection system. So when it finds a tobacco leaf, it latches on to it, and then it injects its RNA into the machinery, the cell-making machinery of the host. And then it takes over the cell-making machinery of the host to make more of itself. You just look at that and you say, okay, I don't think I could design that even if I tried. Mm-hmm. It's so well designed and so specific that you kind of scratch your head and say, why would anybody think that this just came about by chance? But in our state of, in our unawakened state, if you will, not having God as our center and following God, we can easily deceive ourselves to say, well, yes, obviously, since that exists, it had to evolve, and there had to be a reason for it to evolve, and that's the way it evolved. And so we look for evidences that support our thinking, whether it's on the side of God created everything, and on the or on the side of everything evolved. And so obviously we're here, so we had to evolve, and we're just exploring how that evolution took place. And that's kind of the basis of this article, and a lot of articles like these, they always start with a premise that, you know, we've got to exclude the creation part of this and kind of ignore the macro obvious field that one kind of animal does not mate with another kind of animal. You're not going to get a rabbit mating with a tiger, for example. It's just not going to happen. And so you got to ask yourself, why? Why doesn't that happen? And even on the genetic level, you see, well, their genes even look, you know, the chromosomes look way different from one another. They have different number of chromosomes, and there's no way of these chromosomes pairing, you know, at the time of conception, if you will. That should tell you something. That should tell you something about the uniqueness of how God created us.
Well, it should be patently obvious. Now, the conference that Dave and I attended last week in Michigan was not about evolution or the biblical creation story. It was about following Jesus. It was the last days of Jesus. But one of the instructors had an example that he gave us for his argument against evolution, and this came up as he was talking with his children, who were talking evolution from their school system, apparently. And he placed a milk bottle in a place where they couldn't see it. Then they discovered it together, and he said, okay, kids, there are two ways this bottle of milk could have gotten there. Either it could have just appeared from nothing, or somebody put it there. You choose. It's that obvious. You know, that illustrates the point. Dr. Don Clark, biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments, and we enjoy a conversation with Don just about every Tuesday morning. We'll look forward to next week. And Don, thank you for being with us today. It was a treat. And have a good week with your grapes there, and give Andrea a hug for us, okay?
All right, will do. Thank you. Bye-bye. You folks have a good week, too.
Thanks much, Don.